Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, from London, England, where the sun never sets. Not because the empire has been reborn, it's June. It stays light so late, and vice versa. And it is, I'm celebrating close to the first anniversary of my visit to the actual Stonehenge. And I'm given to understand there'll be a bunch of hippies up there to commemorate it. So good on you, lads and lassies. We are not supposed to call it British Petroleum. I'm informed by the British media. The British media. And that plan was going really well until Saturday, when Mr. Green, the goalkeeper for the English team in the World Cup, revealed too late, I think, for most observers, his working history. He had previously run the blowout preventer for BP, and so now there they are once again tagged. Ladies and gentlemen, news of AFA, and this will come as a shock. I know. Well, it'll come as a shock to Richard Holbrooke, because he's our special envoy for Pakistan and Afghanistan. He has long been sidelined by Afghan President Karzai. Karzai doesn't like him. Doesn't like the way he looks. And now it appears the Pakistanis no longer wish to deal with him as well. It's bad news for the special envoy for Pakistan and Afghanistan. Nobody to envoy with. A June 9th visit to Islamabad by Holbrooke was canceled, quote, after he was informed that no important officials would be in Islamabad on the day because of prior commitments, according to the Pakistani newspaper Dawn. Also a good dishwashing liquid. The Holbrooke had planned to visit Islamabad for discussions on the recently concluded India-U.S. strategic dialogue, Hillary Clinton's visit to China, the Afghan peace jirga. Hey, let's all do that. The Afghan peace jirga now, everybody. And more importantly, Pakistani-U.S. official-level talks beginning Friday. Neither President Zardari nor Foreign Minister Qureshi would be in Islamabad. The president would be in Tashkent for a summit of nations that make rugs. And Qureshi would be in Istanbul for the Conference on Interaction and Confidence-Building Measures in Asia summit. That's important work. So, our special envoy. And according to this report from the Long War Journal, neither India nor Central Asian countries want to deal with Holbrooke either. He had to cancel a visit to India and Turkmenistan because of similar problems. The big squash festival in Turkmenistan, I think. And more about our friend Pakistan. It's only, now I know what you think, but it's only the world's fifth most unstable country. See? It's better than Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, and Sudan, in that order, according to the State Department of the United States. And they should know. The department's Global Peace Index was released this week. We were all on tenterhooks waiting for it. I was on pills and needles myself. It reports that Pakistan's overall score deteriorated steadily for the second successive year. It slid three places into the bottom five. We're number five. Pakistan's overall rank is now 145 on a list of 149 countries. All South Asian nations occupy the lower half of the table, headed by Nepal. India, better than Pakistan, is also in the danger zone, ranked 128. Israel rose two places to 144th. Now it's one place ahead of Pakistan. So maybe it's a place Dick Holbrooke doesn't want to be anyway. Hello, welcome to the show. overlooking Leicester Square in London, England. This is Harry Shearer with today's very special edition of Le Show. You know how special it is, because they're all the same. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. And we interrupt this theme to bring you this theme, because this just in. The BBC reports Pakistani intelligence is giving funding, training, and sanctuary to the Afghan Taliban. Can you imagine that? It's on a scale much larger than previously thought. And I previously thought it was a large scale. Taliban field commanders interviewed for this report suggested that ISI, Pakistani intelligence agents, even attend Taliban Supreme Council meetings. It's our friend. They just want to know what's going on. Support for the Afghan Taliban was, quote, official ISI policy, according to the report from the London School of Economics. Pakistan's military denied the claims. Now I'm really surprised. A spokesman said the allegations were rubbish and part of a malicious campaign against the country's military and security agencies. The LSE report comes at the end of one of the deadliest weeks for NATO troops in Afghanistan, so that war is going well. Links between the Taliban and Pakistan's intelligence service have long been suspected, says the BBC. But the report's author, Harvard analyst Matt Waldman, says there's real evidence of extensive cooperation between the two. This goes far beyond just limited or occasional support, he said. This is very significant levels of support being provided by the ISI for the Taliban. You know, like what Saddam did with Al-Qaeda. Oh, sorry. We're also saying this is official policy of that agency, and we're saying that it is very extensive. It is both at an operational level and at a strategic level, right at the senior leadership of the Taliban movement, unquote. Waldman spoke to 9 Taliban field commanders in Afghanistan earlier this year. Some said ISI agents had even attended meetings of the Taliban Supreme Council. They claim that by backing the insurgents, Pakistan's security service is trying to undermine Indian influence in Afghanistan. You see, it's really not about us, ladies and gentlemen. These accounts were corroborated by former Taliban ministers, a Western analyst, and a senior UN official based in Kabul, who said the Taliban largely depend on funding from the ISI, as well as groups in Gulf countries, according to the report. Pakistan and other regional players are increasingly seeking ways to assert their influence in Afghanistan, with U.S. troops due to begin leaving next year. Pakistan is long been accused of using the Taliban to further its foreign policy interests in the country. The ISI first became involved in funding and training militants in Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion in 1979. And we're just visiting. We're just hanging around. The Taliban's former ambassador to Pakistan says there's no proof of a link between the ISI and the Afghan Taliban. The BBC's Quentin Somerville in Kabul says there's a growing understanding that military action alone will not be enough to bring peace in Afghanistan. Okay, then. So let's pull the troops out. Oh, speaking of which, we'll get to more of that area in a moment, but you're probably wondering about the new Iraq up there on the most unstable list. But they're returning to their former ways in at least one particular manner. Folks, and I do mean folks, a new kind of death squad has taken to the streets of Baghdad in an attempt to wipe out the estimated 1 million stray dogs that roam the capital. Sharpshooters packing hunting rifles and poisoned meat, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure, are on the prowl for the canines, which have multiplied since the invasion that toppled Saddam Hussein. Because, you see, Saddam Hussein used to have death squads patrolling to shoot the loose dogs. And then now with the improvement in security over the past 3 years, authorities are reviving that Saddam-era practice of culling Baghdad's stray dog population. We consider this the biggest campaign of dog execution ever, said Baghdad chief veterinarian Mohammed Al-Hili, accompanying a team of shooters. There's one now. He said the campaign had so far killed 42,000 dogs since it was started 2 months ago. More than half were poisoned, for your listening pleasure. This can be considered a victory, he said, as the culling team laid into a pack of dogs. This is from the British newspaper, The Telegraph, by the way. Part of this I can't read to you, ladies and gentlemen, but the dead dogs were loaded onto a tractor to be thrown into pits at Baghdad's garbage dumps. Culling stray dogs was a nightly routine under Saddam, but the rapid deterioration in security after the U.S. invasion kept the vet teams off the streets. Hilly blamed the burgeoning dog population on the huge amounts of litter that began heaping up in the capital as violence paralyzed public services. Now authorities have 20 dedicated teams, each consisting of two shooters and two veterinarians. That's good duty for the vets. Back to that other place. The U.S. government warned Britain it was going into Helmand province in 2006 with too few troops. Not two troops, too few troops. Too few troops, according to the Times of London. Senior U.S. officials warned that 3,300 soldiers was not enough to deal with the Taliban threat in what has become Afghanistan's most dangerous province, although the competition for that title is fierce, I understand. The advice was not heeded. When British forces hit the ground, they spread themselves too thinly and became pinned down under heavy attack, a tactic the Americans said, quote, was like Custer's last stand, unquote. The detail comes as politicians here in Britain call for an inquiry into the Helmand deployment. And, as if related, David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, promised this weekend that British troops would not remain in Afghanistan a day longer than necessary. He gave his broadest hint yet that 10,000 British troops would start to return home next year and confirmed the question of sending more British forces to the country was, quote, not remotely on the agenda, unquote. His visit was disrupted by a security scare, of course. So, the Pakistanis are planning for the post-American, post-British period, because it seems to be coming right around the corner. Hey, there's an election here in 2012, don't you know? Meanwhile, a huge U.S.-led military offensive is expected in the autumn in Afghanistan, amid faltering attempts to get members of the Taliban to lay down their arms. Cameron said, this is the year when we have to make progress. Progress for the sake of the Afghan people, but progress also on behalf of people back at home who want this to work. He admitted not enough progress had been made in bringing security to Helmand province, where the British have been until recently overseeing the military operation. We should be laser-like focused on the thing that matters most of all, which is helping the Afghans to deliver their own security. This will make us safe in the UK and enable us to bring our troops back home. And now for the buried lead, ladies and gentlemen, which might well have been the first paragraph in the story, but no, it's way down here at the bottom. Cameron, the British Prime Minister, said the initial justification for NATO forces going into Afghanistan no longer held true. Quote, clearly we have got rid of the terror training camps, which were the reason we were there in the first place, unquote. But he said that Britain needed to continue to help the Afghan government to take responsibility for its own security. Of course, as far as the Afghan government, the reports that one reads, Afghan government security extends about to the outskirts of Kabul. So they need to take responsibility for that. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news of the Olympic movement. Chairman of the Games, the London Olympic Organizing Committee, Lord Coe, says he has confidence in sponsorship of the 2012 Games by, wait for it, BP. The energy giant's shares and image have taken a pounding since the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded, spewing millions of gallons into the Gulf of Mexico, but Lord Coe described BP as a valued and trusted partner, which is raising £2 billion from the private sector to stage the event. He said, quote, "They clearly have a big issue to deal with and are dealing with it as a world-class company. Ours is a very strong relationship, and I'm delighted they're with us." He said, "Our relationship with BP became a top-tier sponsor of the 2012 Olympics in a glittering ceremony at the British Museum, which has lost its charm, in 2008. Lord Coe said, "Our relationship with BP goes back beyond the bidding process. They were very supportive during the bidding process. They are creative and smart," he said. BP is London 2012's official oil and gas partner. And it's also a sustainability partner alongside BT. Can I call it British Telecom? It is responsible for providing fueling facilities for the vehicles required to keep the games moving. Good luck with that. Proud to be a partner with BP, the Olympic movement. It is a movement, ladies and gentlemen, and we all need one every day. And now, speaking of BP, and we will be for the next little while now. First of all, you know that British Prime Minister Cameron had a conversation with the American President, Barack Obama, over the weekend. And we institute now a new feature of the broadcast, the Weasel Watch. Find the weasel words in this statement from the Prime Minister's office. The Prime Minister expressed his sadness at the ongoing human and environmental catastrophe in Louisiana. The President and Prime Minister agreed that BP should continue to work intensively to ensure that all sensible and reasonable steps are taken as rapidly as practicable to deal with the catastrophe. So we wouldn't want any nonsensible and unreasonable steps to be taken, would we? And who would be the judge of what's sensible and reasonable and practical? I think our oil and fueling partners for the Olympics. Caribbean officials have told Hillary Clinton they are deeply concerned at the prospect of the Gulf of Mexico oil gush reaching their island's pristine beaches, according to the British newspaper The Telegraph, noting the very sobering analysis from Bahamian Foreign Minister T. Brent Simonet on what would happen if the oil reaches the powerful loop current, which would sweep the oil past Florida to the beaches of the Bahamas, Jamaica, and beyond. Clinton said, quote, "We earnestly hope that does not happen," unquote. Antigua's Prime Minister Baldwin Spencer noted the clear anxiety in the region about the spill smearing the shores, which draw millions of tourists to the region each year. Of course, the new figure for the amount of oil gushing out is now up to 40, 50,000 barrels. Wasn't that close to what the unofficial estimates were by the crazy internet people really early in this? Yes, it is. Clinton, Mrs. Secretary of State Clinton, admitted, our understanding of and preparation for dealing with a disaster like this is out of date, unquote. That's it. It's just dated. It's not screwed up. She said there was a need, quote, to start now to get better prepared to deal with something of this magnitude in the future. Many Caribbean countries rely on income from tourism to keep their economies afloat, like Florida. You may not have seen this. The Independent newspaper did a report on an analysis of the spill by our old friend of this broadcast, and soon to be featured in the motion picture The Big Uneasy about why New Orleans flooded, Dr. Bob B. from the University of California, Berkeley, an expert on catastrophe analysis. So here's the Independent. This was a BP operation, but other companies were involved. There's no suggestion of wrongdoing by any of the companies mentioned so far. Some 79 employees worked for Transocean, the firm that owned and operated the rig. A further 41 worked for contractors such as Anadarko Petroleum, one of BP's partners on the well. There was also a firm called M.I. Swaco, or Swaco, a contractor for providing mud engineering services on the rig. Apparently they couldn't hold their... Two of his workers were among the 11 killed, sorry. Halliburton had four staff on the rig and was responsible for cementing on the seabed. Another firm called Cameron International, in relation to the Prime Minister, supplied the rig's blowout preventer valves, which, of course, did not prevent the blowout. The best guide, according to The Independent, as to what went wrong is contained in a report by the Deepwater Horizon Study Group led by Professor B. In his report, he itemizes seven steps which led to the blowout. Improper well design, improper cement design, no cement bond logs, no paper logs of the operation of bonding the cement to the well, ineffective oversight of operations, bad decision-making, removing the pressure barrier, early warning signs not detected, analyzed, or corrected, improper operating procedures, flawed design and maintenance of the final line of defense. B does not specify any company other than BP, but he does have harsh words to say about one other organization, the U.S. regulator in the area. He says, the information available to me so far indicates that BP and the Department of Interior's Minerals Management Service failed to properly assess and manage the natural hazards in a prudent manner. Consequently, the public resources and environment were and are being severely punished. I don't recall the U.S. ambassador to London pointing that out when he tried to smooth over relations today on BBC with the Brits. And, you know, oh, no, relations are fine. We love BP. They help the Olympics. Further on this subject, to give you some background on the fine work that BP does. I'm just turning this knob for a moment. And then we get to this. From the nonprofit journalism site ProPublica, a series of investigations over the past decade warned senior BP managers that the oil company repeatedly disregarded safety and environmental rules and risked a serious accident if it did not change its ways. The confidential inquiries, which have not been previously made public, focused on a rash of problems at BP's Alaska drilling operations. They described instances in which management flouted safety by neglecting aging equipment, pressured employees not to report problems, and cut short or delayed inspections to reduce costs. Well, we wanted to save money. Similar themes about BP operations elsewhere were sounded in interviews with former employees, in lawsuits and little-noticed state inquiries, and in emails obtained by ProPublica. Taken together, these documents portray a company that systematically ignored its own safety policies across its North American operations from Alaska to the Gulf of Mexico. Executives were not held accountable for the failures. Some were promoted despite them. Sounds like the Corps of Engineers. You guys should work together. Under Tony Hayward, since 2007 chief executive of BP, the company has worked to implement an operating safety system to create, quote, responsible operations at every BP operation, says a spokesman. BP has used the system at 80% of its operations and expects to bring it to the rest by the end of the year. Because of its string of accidents before the blowout in the Gulf, BP faced a possible ban on federal contracting and on new U.S. drilling leases, according to several senior former EPA officials. That inquiry has taken on new significance. One key question the EPA will consider is whether the company's leadership can be trusted. Yeah, good question. And whether BP's culture can change. A possible hint about that comes from this. This is Tony Hayward, who, it would seem, the one piece of PR advice he has taken and taken to heart is, you're in America, babe, talk slow. So here is the slowest talking Brit in North America, Tony Hayward, being interviewed on Fox News on May 20th of this year regarding whether, well, just how much oil is spewing from the well.
There is no accurate way of estimating this, I'm afraid. There clearly is not a meter on the seabed. So what you have to do is estimate what is on the surface, which itself is something of an estimation, and then back calculate based on the amount of oil that evaporates and is dispersed as it travels up through the sea column. So, the numbers are genuinely guesstimates at this point. What we can say is that the containment efforts of subsea dispersant, dispersant deployed on the surface, skimming on the surface, and booming on the surface is retaining the vast majority of the oil in the vicinity of the leak.
Well, of course, that didn't turn out to be true. But there's no way to know how much oil is coming out, said Tony Hayward, May 20th. This from BP's own magazine, Frontiers, August 2008. To tackle the industry-wide problem of flow measurement, engineers in BP set out a few years ago to develop a more reliable and cost-effective method for continuously metering hydrocarbon flows. BP had a vision that a different technique, that of sonar-based measurement, could hold the answer to this, says Nicholas Morlino, Research and Development Program Manager with BP in Houston. From our in-depth knowledge of flow measurement methods built up over many years, we know that sonar flow measurement is not so readily affected by the presence of small percentages of liquids or gases. And the way sonar metering technology works meant it could be achievable without inserting anything into the flow itself. It's cost-effective to install a meter on every well to allow us to monitor them all continuously to provide us with a picture of which wells to focus on for optimizing oil production. Other companies have now begun to use the meters, but BP is leading the way. It appears that measuring hydrocarbon flows may be less problematic in the future thanks to BP's creative vision for sonar flow measurement. BP has now deployed the meters in its refineries in the U.S. and sees numerous applications in its wider downstream operations. Installation of the meter by clamping it onto a pipe takes only around an hour. BP has already deployed around 45 sonar flow meters around its operations. But there's no way to know how much oil is flowing because we don't have a meter down there. So, the question is: Can you trust the management to change the culture? And those skimmers are working very well now. Tony will be, Tony Hayward will be meeting with the president later this week, and we'll be talking even more slowly then.
Like you wanted to do. Tell me why you wanna be so gone. that you were stepping on my heart as you were walking out the door. And now you've gone, and I'm glad, bye-bye, that we didn't let it get too bad. You know I tried to make it go, but there was just no way to tell you so. Baby, why you wanna be so cold?
Be so cold.
Tell me why you wanna be so mean?
Be so mean.
Hey, babe, you're gonna let your true color show. You're a perpetual machine. Tell me why you wanna be so cold?
Be so cold.
Oh, why you wanna be so mean?
Be so mean.
Yes, you're gonna let your true color show. You're a perpetual. Yeah, 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 yeah. Tell me why.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, the President's Weekly Address. Now, from the President's Address, the President.
I just finished a half-hour telephone conversation with the British Prime Minister, or, as he would now like to be called, the Prime Minister, lest further anti-British sentiment be whipped up. During that conversation, he stressed to me the economic importance of the company formerly known as British Petroleum. I stressed to him in response the necessity for appearing to keep America's boot on that company's multinational neck. I told him that the American people have made it clear that they want their president to express their anger over this unprecedented environmental catastrophe. Earlier this week, you may have seen me in a television interview with Matt Lauer. He asked me if it was time for me to kick some butt. I responded that I was consulting with experts to find out the right asses to kick. That's the kind of response you can expect from your president as this crisis goes forward. Whenever strong language is called for, I will meet and exceed that call. But it's not just words that the American people expect at this time of ecological and economic disaster. It's action. That's why I'm going back to the Gulf Coast once again this week, my fourth visit in just over a month. While there, I will repeat my message to all responsible officials. Plug the damn leak. In case they don't grasp that clear message, I stand ready to use a stronger adjective than damn. If and when I do so, you will, if you choose, be the first to know. It's important for you, the American people, to understand just how angry I am about this mess, and have been since day one of my anger. I'm angry enough to impose a 6-month oil drilling moratorium on a state whose fishing industry has already been crippled, so we can take all the time we need to get past the midterm elections. I'm angry enough to throw this decorative BP paperweight right down on the floor. And as Prime Minister Cameron now appreciates, I'm angry enough to continue calling BP British Petroleum. Thanks, and have a good week.
Funds for this broadcast came from the Funds for This Broadcast Fund. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Yes, the British goalkeeper is sorry. You know that. He apologized for two British Sunday newspapers called Hands of Clod. Not Claude, Clod. The Israeli government has apologized after the its press office emailed to journalists a spoof video about the flotilla which tried to dock in Gaza. The video shows people dressed as peace activists singing "We Con the World" to the tune of "We Are the World." A spokesman said the video did not represent the Israeli government's view. The video contains real footage of the Israeli raid on the flotilla in which 9 activists died. In the clip, which parodies the video made for the 1985 charity song, the singers are dressed up in costumes representing the captain of the flotilla, Western peace activists, and the Arabs wearing scarves. Mark Regev, Regev, spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister's office, said, "I call my kids in to watch it because I thought it was funny. It is what Israelis feel, but the government has nothing to do with it." The video was made by the Hebrew satirical website Latma.com, or actually .co.il, which is Israel's domain name. The chairman of the insurance giant Prudential, not related to the American Prudential. This is the British. Oh, I can't say that. It's Prudential from some other country. Apologized this week for the costs incurred by the failed takeover of the American International Group's Asian business. The chairman rejected calls for him and the chief executive to resign. The chairman, Harvey McGrath, told investors at the annual meeting the board remains convinced it was right to pursue this opportunity and that he saw no reason why any director should resign. But some private shareholders remain unimpressed and repeatedly interrupted the meeting with shouts of, "Shame on you!" But wait, there's more. Golden Tate, a rookie wide receiver with the Seattle Seahawks, apologized this week after the police in suburban Seattle gave him a warning for trespassing into a gourmet donut shop last weekend. Gourmet donuts, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure. Tate, a former Notre Dame star, said it was a foolish mistake, but he was glad to have learned a lesson without being arrested. He said a friend took a couple of maple bars from the shop early in the morning. He said they are irresistible. Broadway star Alice Ripley issued a public apology after using a gay slur. Ripley, who stars in Next to Normal on Broadway, used the gay slur in a Facebook posting last week. The post read, "This frustrated actor, I won't say gay slur, is my new best friend." Ripley followed up with a statement on her Facebook page where she referred to her previous post as careless and thoughtless. She went on to say, "I've always supported the gay community and will continue to do so. I'm embarrassed and I apologize." I guess there are a lot of gay people like to go to the theater. The New York Mets have apologized to Jerry Seinfeld after Lady Gaga stripped down to just her bejeweled bra and panties and retreated to the privacy of the comedian's unoccupied box seats during the game against San Diego. She created more controversy when she's photographed giving the finger at the game. She must like to be photographed. The Mets say, "We deeply regret that Jerry Seinfeld has been associated with this matter and have apologized to him." She, the Gaga one, did not like the seat she was originally given right behind home plate. Too good a view of the game, I guess. Furious at the attention. Yeah, Gaga was caught on camera flipping the bird to thousands of fans. The use of Jerry Seinfeld's suite was unauthorized and unknown to him at the time, a team spokesperson said. So it worked out well for her. I hope she enjoyed the game, too. Yuma, Arizona Mayor Al Krieger told the Yuma Sun he apologized for a comment he made about gays in the military during Memorial Day speech, which has since sparked some national headlines. During the speech at Desert Lawn Memorial Park, Krieger expressed his disapproval of the proposed repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The mayor said, quote, "And I cannot believe that a bunch of lacy-drawered, limp-wristed people could do what these men have done in the past," unquote. Those comments have since gone viral on the Internet, have gathered national attention from the media and gay rights groups. Even Alice Ripley complained. No, she didn't. The Huffington Post and The Advocate, a major gay and lesbian news magazine, wrote articles on it. The Advocate's story carried the headline, quote, "Mayor fears limp-wristed soldiers." In a phone interview with the Yuma Sun, Krieger apologized to the gay community. "As mayor, I must respect the lifestyle choices of others, no matter how disagreeable they are with my personal beliefs or my personal moral standards." Yes, it's an apology. "I apologize for my comments at the Memorial Day service at Desert Lawn Cemetery on Memorial Day." Nice one, Mayor. Nice apology. Almost limp-wristed. These have been tough weeks for Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar, of course, involved in the Gulf oil blowout. He has had to apologize to experts who were called in by the Obama administration to evaluate how to respond to the crisis for misrepresenting their views about an offshore drilling moratorium. The experts did not suggest a moratorium, but Salazar, when he proposed it, didn't mention that fact. He has apologized. Slovenian Prime Minister Borut Pahor apologized for a comment he made during a debate with students the day before where he complained about being unable to live on his government salary. Responding to questions about how students from low-income families could cover the cost of education, Pahor stated, I earn 3,000 to 2 euros. I cannot get by on my salary. In his apology, Pahor said his intent was not to complain about his salary, but to show students that even he, as prime minister, was struggling with financial issues. Maybe that statement wasn't necessary, but it's the truth. If anyone was insulted by it, I apologize, he said, giving everyone an iffer. That's what I'm going to call them now. They're iffers. North Carolina State Ports Authority Chief Executive Tom Eager apologized to Southport, North Carolina Mayor Robert Howard for his remarks to the Raleigh News and Observer. Characterizing an opposition group to the port, Eager told the News and Observer, they're a very small group, they're new to North Carolina, they're extremely biased, and quite honestly, they're misinformed. In his letter, Eager apologizes to Howard for those remarks. Another World Cup apology, ITV was forced to apologize to viewers following an interruption during its live broadcast of the game last night, the U.S.-England game. Viewer of the channel's high-definition channel missed Steven Gerrard's goal for England when the coverage switched to commercial. ITV presenter Adrian Chiles apologized to viewers during the halftime break. But it's high-def. It was a high-def commercial. You didn't like... Labour Party Member of Parliament John McDonnell here in Britain said he was sorry if he caused offence with his remarks about former Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher at a Labour leadership event. He said if he could go back in time, he would, quote, assassinate Thatcher. And a local talk radio station in Columbus, Ohio, has apologized for insensitive language it used to promote a giveaway trip to Phoenix after Columbus's mayor suspended city travel to Arizona. Columbus officials said WTVN pledged this week to work with the city to build better community relations. The apology came on air last week during a meeting with community leaders. This week, the promotion characterized Phoenix as a city where Americans are proud and illegals are scared. It also suggested the winner could spend the weekend, quote, chasing aliens. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This week, with the oil spill in the news almost nonstop, except for Joran van der Sloot, former President Bush, inaugurated his Facebook page with what he called his inaugural address. It did not include this song.
Cause I'm an old man. Just in a turnip, you can't pee up a rope. The minute we got started, we were on that slippery slope. The problem with solutions is that they take too much toll. It's like a kind of sickness we're addicted to all. No, it's like a kind of sickness we're addicted to all. Oh, Lord, I wish you'd help us. We're addicted to oil.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Scientists at the University of Miami say Greenland's ice is melting so quickly the land underneath is rising at an accelerated pace. According to the study, some coastal areas in Greenland are going up by nearly 1 inch per year. And if current trends continue, that number could accelerate to as much as 2 inches per year by 2025, says Professor Tom Dixon, professor of geophysics at the University of Miami. It's been known for several years that climate change is contributing to the melting of Greenland's ice sheet, he says. What's surprising and a bit worrisome is that the ice is melting so fast we can actually see the land uplift in response. Even more surprising, the rise seems to be accelerating, implying that melting is accelerating. That's what Louisiana needs, is get some of that ice to melt so the land will rise. Wouldn't that? Dayline Berkeley, vegetation around the world is on the move and climate change is the culprit. Vegetation is on the move? They can move? Wow. They seem to look so still when I stare at them. According to a new analysis of global vegetation shifts led by a UC Berkeley ecologist in collaboration with researchers from the Department of Agriculture, published a paper in the journal Global Ecology and Biogeography. The researchers present evidence that over the past century, vegetation has been gradually moving toward the poles and up mountain slopes where temperatures are cooler, as well as toward the equator where there's more rainfall. Moreover, an estimated one-tenth to one-half of the land mass on Earth will be highly vulnerable to climate-related vegetation shifts by the end of this century, depending on how effectively humans are able to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Okay. If I'm a betting plant, I'm betting, take me to the equator now! The results came from a meta-analysis of hundreds of field studies and a spatial analysis of observed 20th century climate and projected 21st century vegetation. Northern California's two great marine sanctuaries in nearby coastal regions will be severely threatened by the planet's changing climate over the next several decades as the sea level rises, the ocean water warms, marine animals migrate, and coastal storms and erosion intensify, according to a panel of scientists. They've been studying the issue for the past 2 years and report that sea level at the mouth of San Francisco Bay has already risen nearly 8 inches in the past century. They noted that the most recent estimates of global warming's impact on the ocean off the California coast indicates a sea level rise of 29 inches in the next 40 years. The effects of this rise will play out everywhere, says John Largier, a UC Davis oceanographer. Some ocean species are already adapting to warming waters off the coast by moving northward. They're following the plants, wouldn't you? For example, gray whales, which normally give birth in the warm lagoons of Baja California, are beginning to move calving grounds northward. Some whales have been observed giving birth as far north as the waters off Monterey County, just south of San Francisco. There's more and more evidence of rapid adaptation by marine life to changes in the climate, says Largier, but as changes grow greater, adaptation will end, and how much we will lose along the way we can't predict. Sea levels may rise by as much as 1 meter, I have no idea how much that is, before the end of the century, according to new predictions. Melting glaciers may contribute more to the rise in sea levels than scientists have previously realized. And the Himalayan glaciers that feed Asia's five largest rivers are in no danger of disappearing by 2035, as claimed in the Climate Change Panel's most recent report. In fact, only the glaciers that melt into the Ganges are shrinking, according to the most detailed analysis yet of how climate change will affect key Asian glaciers. So, a little good news there, unless you're living on the Ganges. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Thank you. And if the music's not hip enough, how about this? More than a year after the CIA's Inspector General stepped down, there's still no Inspector General at the CIA. Several possible candidates have fallen by the wayside, despite assurances from the Obama administration. Assurances from the Obama administration that a nominee will be chosen soon. The watchdog position was central in uncovering abuses inside the spy agency, but we don't need that anymore. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 right over there in Berlin, around the world via the internet. At two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. Available on your smartphone through stitcher.com, which an alert listener noticed had on the Le Show page last week a banner ad for BP. Happy to be a partner with you guys. Let's do the Olympics together. What do you say? Available as a free download to subscribers at audible.com/LeShow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like Tony Hayward being able to talk fast again if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead and to Adrian Bodenham at Global Radio here in London for helping to make today's Le Show the thing that is almost over. By the way, if you're in London town, come see us at Royal Festival Hall Thursday evening. Addicted to Oil, one of the songs. I'll be performing live along with the UK premiere of Deaf Boys at an evening of political song at part of the Meltdown Festival. And Richard Thompson and Judith Owen will be there too. The email address for this broadcast and the playlist of the music heard here on, just part of the Festival of Internet Goodness, available for you at harryshearer.com. And Le Show is on Twitter, at LeTwits. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Forgot my own sign-off. So long from the United Kingdom.